You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of January 2013 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Moncler. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Burma's admitted it's used jets to attack rebels. After 2 years on the road to reform, has the country taken a giant leap backwards? We'll be in Delhi asking whether India's attitudes to women are about to change, and we'll be in Argentina too for the latest on the transatlantic wranglings over the Falkland Islands.
Argentina's President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner has taken out an open letter to David Cameron in several UK newspapers, basically criticising what it sees as the UK's colonial attitude towards the Falklands.
Find out why new mothers in Iceland could end up on the wrong side of the law if they give their newborn the wrong name.
So it wouldn't fit to give a girl this name. So in legal terms, she is only known in the system as girl.
And is the mayor of Middle of the Road about to go all luxurious? We'll work out why Gap is buying high-end fashion brand Intermix. All that plus we play some music too, of course, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. Before all of that, let's catch up on the latest headlines. Here's Jonathan Wheatley.
The recent US fiscal cliff deal has not entirely solved the country's massive deficit problem, but has temporarily calmed things down and rallied markets on both sides of the Atlantic. Financial analyst Dean Baker is from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and Daniel Hansen is from the American Enterprise Institute.
I think at the end of the day, we've seen both sides be prepared to bluster. No one here is crazy, so I think it's a pretty safe bet that they're not going to let the U.S. actually default on its debt.
You know, the expansion in entitlements is the thing that's driving, is the main driver of the deficits and the debt. And until they can get some sort of longer-term compromise about how to tame growth in entitlements, they're not going to be able to really tame the growth of deficits and debts.
A Pakistani man accused by British authorities of being an Al-Qaeda operative who took part in a plot to bomb US and English targets was extradited today from Britain to the United States to face terrorism charges. Abid Nasir is one of many arrested in April 2009 on suspicion of preparing to cause mass casualties by bombing Manchester in England. Six men have been charged with a gang rape and murder of a 23-year-old medical student in New Delhi. If convicted, five of them could face the death penalty, but the sixth is under 18 and could face life imprisonment instead. The victim, who was attacked on the 16th of December, later died of her injuries. Police requested that the identity of the girl remain secret.
A concerned regular magistrate would see conduct the case on that day. The name of the girl had been blurred so that it should be kept secret, and certain document he had deposed before the court, he had stated before the court, are in sealed cover. He had further submitted that all efforts should be made to keep the identity of the girl in secret.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's ruling Likud party and Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman's Yisrael Beitenu party are expected to win the general election on the 22nd of January, and this is worrying the Palestinian side, which believes both Israeli political parties are ignoring the peace process. Mahdi Abdul Hadi is a Palestinian political analyst.
And whether we like it or not, Palestine and Palestinians are becoming an internal Israeli issue and vice versa. Everything in Israel is becoming an internal Palestinian issue. We are too much engaged together on a daily basis, in spite of people will deny or ignore or hide the message. But by the end of the day, we are too much involved with each other.
Here, keepers have started the mammoth annual task of counting all creatures at London Zoo, which is home to more than 17,500 animals, birds, reptiles, fish and invertebrates. The yearly stocktake is fun for the playful penguins, who dive around in their pool as the keeper tries to keep count. The zoological director is David Field.
But flocks of birds, especially in our big free-flight aviaries, they can be a little bit challenging. But this is about reconciling our records. Every day the keepers come in and they check and count their animals. And we just need now just to make sure all of our data is correct. Because it's not just about how many animals we've got, but we also need to make sure who we've got.
And finally, dog owners in Wales could face criminal prosecution if their animals bite burglars. The Welsh Government is considering proposals making it illegal for dogs to be out of control on private property. So it looks as if dogs in Wales will be biting off far more than they can chew. That's the latest news here on Monocle 24.
Boom, boom, Jonathan Wheatley. Thank you very much. 5 minutes past the hour here on Midori House, here on Monocle 24.
Van uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Wij uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London, Europe, London,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong. Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House. And for 2 years, the progress of Burma's military-led government towards reform has been watched by an applauding international community. The prisoner amnesties, the new labour laws and the relaxation of press censorship have all been held up as pleasing examples of Burma's democratic journey. But reports are emerging for the first time in a long time of a crackdown in Burma against dissent. The government has admitted it's been attacking rebel fighters in the northern state of Kachin. Rebel sources have been claiming they've been being attacked from the ground and from above since December the 28th. So after the hyperbole and the high-profile photo ops, is this a sign that Burma's returning to its old ways? Well, Khun Toy is leader of the Kachin community here in London, and he joins me now. Welcome to Midori House. Perhaps you could start by telling us exactly what these rebels want. Are they looking for autonomy or a change of government at the top?
Kachin autonomy, Kachin KO, we want the autonomous, which is agreed by the Panglong Agreement, which was a founding agreement of the Union of Burma. And the since last year, 2011 June, Burmese military broke ceasefire and they attacked us again.
What is it about Kachin that means it's being fought over in this way? Is it rich in natural resources?
Yes, rich in natural resources, but the problems in Burma, especially the ethnic tensions, is mainly 2008 constitutions to blame. The new government should initiate the political dialogue rather than the military solution. We had the ceasefire for 17 years. The ceasefire broke last year, 2011 June. So more intensified military assaults since beginning of December 25, 2012 until, yes.
What was it that broke the ceasefire back in the middle of 2011?
Well, we have the ceasefire for 17 years, and the Burmese that time the military regime not willing to carry on the political dialogues, and they just keep dragging into the militarization in the Kachin state. So this the government, the military junta said they will allow us to do the political dialogues when we got the new government, but it's never happened since last 2011.
Now, the military junta says that rebels in the area have been preventing the flow of essential supplies to other parts of Burma. They've essentially been disrupting a supply route. Doesn't that mean that that the government needs to intervene, has a duty to intervene, doesn't it, to look after the rest of the citizens?
From our point of view, this is totally different. The military not want to provide the relief humanitarian support in the KO control area. It's totally blocked out. Some of you might have heard the UN, the EU arguing for the relief supplies, free flow of relief supply in the non-government control area.
We talked about press freedoms in the lead-in to this. How is this incident, which appears to have been going on for several days, though the ruling junta has only just acknowledged that it's been happening. How has this been reported in Burma?
Well, they took the chance for the Christmas and New Year holiday. There's a lot of people, the government officials, especially press correspondents in Burma, they're enjoying with the celebration. And they took that opportunity, actually. So since yesterday, a lot of news came up because we've been reporting, we've been feeding this news to the UK government and the other news agents for many days. But the news was broke by the BBC World Service yesterday. Yes.
Chemical weapons have apparently been used. How much do you know about this?
Well, that the chemical weapon was, we can trace from like the one identical to the one they used in the copper mining in the Lebanon area.
Okay, well, what, perhaps you could talk to us about China, because historically the rebel group that operates in this area has been backed by China in the past, but in order for this to happen, presumably Chinese airspace has been used by these jets.
Yes, China blind eye on use of its airspace by military air force. We doubt that the Burmese government offer some business concession in return.
Okay, Kun Toi, we will have to leave it there. He's the leader of the Kachin community in London. Thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. We'll be back with a look at gender equality in India and the court case that started it all in Delhi very shortly.
Montclair, keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
The Entrepreneurs is about the movers and shakers, the lone rangers, the innovators, the modern mercantile mavericks, and the venerable merchandisers. It's Monocle 24's weekly business show. Every week, we seek out the startups, the brands on the make, and the leaders of global business empires doing things differently.
Assume you don't know the answer. If you assume that, you have to start creating options for yourself.
From master cobblers to asset managers, from impresarios in the luxury yacht sector to tech startups shaking up Silicon Valley. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1900 hours London time or download the show on Monocle 24's website.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
You're listening to Midori House. I'm Dominic Reynolds. Now, five men were charged in an Indian court today with the rape and murder of a 23-year-old medical student on a bus in Delhi last month. The public outcry around the case has prompted thousands of women to report cases of sexual violence. It's also prompted the rest of the world to look more closely at this emerging superpower's attitudes to gender equality. Well, Arta Bettigeri joins us on the line from Delhi. Hello, Arti. Thanks for joining us. I hear you've been down to the court today. What did you see?
Hello, Dominic. Yes, I was indeed down at the court in a suburb called Saket in the south of the city, which is the most mainly residential and more upmarket. And it's the court is adjacent to one of the biggest shopping malls in Delhi called City Walk. At the court today, there were a few police around. There wasn't a lot of visible security. There were throngs and throngs of cameras and journalists absolutely everywhere. That was the most visible thing that I could see. Now, what actually happened today was that what was meant to happen was that police were meant to present the evidence. They had like 1,000 pages of evidence. They were meant to present that to a magistrate. The magistrate, in turn, was going to transfer the case over to a special new fast-track court that's been set up just very recently to hear, firstly, this case and then a backlog of rape cases. The police didn't make it to court in time, so while they got to present the evidence, it wasn't in time for the magistrate to transfer it over. So that will happen on Saturday now.
So we've got a fast-track court being set up, and this is going to... Is this going to continue... It's been set up very quickly, but is it going to sort of last in perpetuity? Is it going to hear a lot of these sorts of cases as we go forward?
look, I don't know about perpetuity, but there is a massive, massive backlog of rape cases. A figure that I saw and I can't confirm is about 90,000 rape cases have not yet been heard. The next case that's going to come up is another really awful one, but that's been pending for 8 years, in which this one woman who was 16 at the time, she was held for 40 days and raped by 42 men in the southern state of Kerala. So I think as this court progresses, a lot more very, very grisly details about the sort of attacks that women across the country have endured for a long time now are going to come out, and they'll actually be covered. I mean, every single day in the papers you read accounts of horrific rapes and murders. And I think Indians have been quite inured to it, but there was something about this case that just really galvanised people like no other. And, you know, kind of collectively, Indians just said, this is it, we're mad as hell, we're not going to take it anymore, we need to take some action, we can't have this happen again.
This sort of attitude to women has hardly been sort of brushed under the carpet. It's there, it's very well known, as anyone who's travelled to India will know, that in this particular area, they haven't evolved sort of fast enough, along with the scale of their economy, certainly. So has the international community been guilty of sort of putting this in the corner, you know, ignoring the elephant in the room on this issue?
Okay, yeah, I feel a bit awkward about, you know, commenting on that. I mean, that's how I that's what I believe. But I mean, you know, it's I don't think you'll find many people in positions of authority who attest to that.
Okay, well, Aunty, perhaps you could talk to us about the sort of policing issue around this, because as far as I can tell, the sort of attitudes that have allowed these sort of things to go on have quite a lot been down to the fact that the policing hasn't been very secure, so people haven't felt confident in reporting these sorts of crime. Is there any sense that aspect is going to change?
You're absolutely right. Police are widely distrusted in India. And when it comes to sexual assaults, for some reason they just don't seem to take it seriously. For example, a case was reported recently where a woman was raped in Punjab, and the police refused to file her, refused to take her testimony. I think it was testimony that they refused to actually put through the case that she was trying to present. They were saying, look, let's break her deal. Either you just let it go, forget about it, or maybe you can marry one of the perpetrators. The issue in Delhi is that we've got this massive, modern, outward-looking city, smack bang in the most backward, the most feudally-minded part of India, you know, the states of Rajasthan and Haryana Uttar Pradesh. They're extremely backward. You drive half an hour out of Delhi, you do not see a single woman on the street.
Aarti, we're going to have to leave it there, but fascinating to talk to you as ever. That's Aarti Bettigeri in Delhi. You're listening to Midori House. Now, here's an interesting New Year diet idea. Follow a regime exclusively based on the health advice that screams out of the front pages of many mid-market newspapers. You would, on any given month, be giving up red wine, taking up red meat, drinking 4 litres of water before lunch, and exercising in brief 3-minute chunks up to 12 times a day, before doing it all in reverse 3 months later when a new study finds something else. So why is the advice on what's good for us and what isn't apparently so contradictory? And why do we all care so much? Well, Julian Baghini has written on this subject. He's the founding editor of The Philosopher's Magazine and joins us now. Julian, an article of yours caught our eye in the Independent newspaper today. Why does the advice seem to vary so wildly?
Well, to be fair, I think the advice isn't varying so wildly in the first place. Most of the times what happens is someone puts out a study and they discover a very specific kind of connection between things. And then sometimes it's a researcher, but sometimes it's a spin of the newspaper. They just translate that into something you ought to do. And that doesn't necessarily follow. So, for example, if it turns out that on average, people who drink more red wine have less, say, heart trouble, that doesn't necessarily automatically translate into the advice to drink more red wine, because everything's much more complicated than that. So it's the way it's spun, really, which is generally the problem. As I say, and normally, to be fair, that's not the fault of the researchers, it's the reporting.
But it's also the fault of the people who buy the newspapers in greater numbers when they have a story about diabetes being cured by eating sugar lumps or something on the front page. So why are we all obsessed with these articles?
Well, the first thing is we all do want to be healthier. But I think we have kind of bought into a lot of the way this kind of myth that somehow health and mortality, morbidity is kind of controllable. You know, I think people do kind of believe if you eat the right things, if you do the right things, exercise the right way, you can kind of make yourself invulnerable. And I think in a way, what we don't want to admit is that in fact we're largely not in control of these things. The things which strike us down ill, yes, sometimes they are very clearly related to lifestyle, but they tend to be at the extreme. If someone is very obese, if they've been smoking all their lives, if they're very heavy drinkers, they may well get something which is directly related to that. But if you think of most people you know yourself and people in family, when they get ill, it's just random bad luck, and I think we don't like that idea. So it's a way of thinking we can exert more control over our health and destiny than we actually can by just eating right, you know.
Well, Julian, let's apply these newfound pieces of wisdom to a recent medical story. A couple of days ago, or perhaps it was even yesterday, I heard that people who are a little bit overweight or a little bit podgy actually have longer lives than people who are very slim or very obese. So talk to us about this.
Well, that's an interesting one. It's not the first time that's been found, actually. So, I mean, I think, again, you have to look at patterns. When you look at patterns, I think we should be sceptical about this idea that the ideal weight is this BMI, body mass index, of 20 to 25. Quite a lot of studies suggest that at the very least there's no problem with being a bit over it, and indeed the optimal might be over it. But again, as the researcher was quoted in some of the reporting on this study pointed out, the fact that people who are overweight tend to live longer doesn't mean they have better health overall. So you have got to think about what's most important to you. It's generally the case that you are healthier if you are a good weight, and you have all sorts of problems which can make your life much more difficult and limit what you can do if you're very overweight. So, I mean, that's the real key thing. You see, it's leaping on the one thing, they live longer, and then jumping to the conclusion that means therefore we should do it. And also do remember, we're always talking about averages, and often the differences aren't that huge. I mean, for example, something is said to double your risk of something, but if your risk of that thing is already very, very small, doubling the risk of it isn't really a big problem.
Oh, but don't ruin the little party for sub-editors who love all of that stuff. I mean, why do we feel like we need to sort of oversimplify things? Like, it seems like you're sort of saying that as opposed to living by broad principles and sort of enforcing our own rules in the grey area, we want to live by a certain, you know, we need to do X number of minutes of exercise per day, and then we can do whatever we like the rest of the time. Why are we trying to sort of codify everything like this?
Well, I think it just makes life more manageable to us. I think, you know, obviously accepting the fact that we are complex systems in which everything interacts means you've got a lot more to think about. So I think it basically gives us the idea that things are simpler. But I think what's very interesting about this is that if you think about it, this kind of way of looking at things, that you boil things down to very particular things and you follow from there, it's often criticized as this sort of excessively scientific way of thinking, reductionism, they call it, you know. But actually, that pattern of thinking is also found by people who are very suspicious of mainstream science. You go into any kind of health food store which is selling remedies which are all complementary, they too promise exactly the same kind of thing. Take this particular supplement and it will give you this particular benefit, irrespective of what else is going on in your life. So it is interesting that whether or not people are kind of generally pro or anti or suspicious of science, it seems that the broader culture follows this idea that, as I say, you by pushing certain buttons with certain foods, you will get a simple outcome. It does make life seem more manageable, don't you think? Because it's quite a messy, complicated thing.
Indeed, it is. It is very complicated. And to add maybe an extra level of complication to it, what about things that, you know, may technically be not particularly positive for my health? Let's say I wanted to drink a glass of red wine every night and I've just read an article saying that's not particularly good for me. But, so health-wise, that's not good for me. But maybe sort of psychologically, emotionally, I enjoy that. And overall, my sort of holistic health might be better.
Yeah, no, I do think that's right. I mean, you've got to think your well-being is not just about servicing the machine. I mean, I think if we're to take a hypothetical choice, your body is working perfectly and you're miserable, or your body's working imperfectly but adequately and you're happy. I mean, I think everyone surely would take the second route. So I think that is true. Of course, it only becomes a problem if those things which are causing real problems. I mean, sometimes people say, I mean, I used to get very frustrated with smokers who said, oh, I don't care if I get cancer kind of thing. I mean, you know, cancer is very, very horrible. You really don't want it. But most of the things we're talking about here are very, very marginal. You slightly increase your risk of being unhealthy. And if something that you really enjoy and gives a lot of pleasure in your life gives a small increase in your risk, I think you're right. It's a trade-off we should go for. It doesn't seem to me remotely obvious or a good idea that whatever we should do should always be based on maximizing the condition of our body or the length of our lives. There are other things we value more than that.
Well, on that note, there was a story, I think a few days ago, suggesting that most people disregard the sort of how densely calorific alcohol is, and that people sort of ignore the fact that there's no nutritional benefit for, in most cases, lots of calories. So, I mean, in this whole sort of world of headlines around the things that we eat and drink, are we all guilty of sort of ignoring the fact that alcohol really is just pretty bad for you and that's it?
Whatever it isn't, I think it's very mixed. But the other thing is, I mean, you know, shock horror, it's empty calories, it's not good for you. That would only be a problem if you thought that every food you eat has to serve the purpose of nutrition. Now, that's a really functional view. Now, obviously, we need good nutrition. We need to make sure that, generally speaking, we're eating good things. But why should it be a problem if a certain proportion of our food intake, calorie intake, isn't doing anything for our health at all? As long as it's not causing us huge problems, why should that be a problem? Because food and drink is not just about fuel, is it? It is about pleasure and enjoyment, and it's not just in a crude way either. You know, if you're into your wine, you can really appreciate all the work and the skill and everything that's gone into, the tradition that's gone into that wine. So, yeah, I just think, again, it'd be very sad if we thought that the sole basis we should use to judge whether we should eat or drink something is whether it has some kind of nutritional benefit. That seems to me reduces us to the level of just biological machines to be serviced and put into action.
Julian, I feel so much better already. Thank you very much. That was Julian Baghini, founding editor of the Philosopher's Magazine and a writer on health issues. Now, before the news at 1:30 the hour, let's have some music from Italy. This is Fitness Forever with Brazil. fitness forever with Brazil. Now, in the next half hour of the programme, we're going to be finding out about GAP's potential journey into the luxury market. And very shortly, we're going to be talking about Argentina, Britain and the Falkland Islands. Before all of that is Jonathan Wheatley. He's got the world news headlines.
Thank you very much. A Pakistani man accused by British authorities of being an Al-Qaeda operative who took part in a plot to bomb US and English targets was extradited today from Britain to the United States to face terrorism charges. Abid Nasir was one of many arrested in April 2009 on suspicion of preparing to cause mass casualties by bombing Manchester here in England. Six men have been charged with the gang rape and murder of a 23-year-old medical student in New Delhi. If convicted, five of them could face the death penalty. The sixth is under 18 years old and could face life imprisonment instead. The victim was attacked on the 16th of December and later died of her injuries. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's ruling Likud party and Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman's Yisrael Beitenu party are expected to win the general election on the 22nd of January, but this is worrying the Palestinian side, which believes both parties will ignore the peace process. And the recent US fiscal cliff deal has not entirely solved the country's massive deficit problem, but has temporarily calmed things down and rallied markets on both sides of the Atlantic. And that's the latest news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24. We're coming to you live from London. Now, 180 years ago to the day after the UK took over the Falkland Islands, Argentinian President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner has demanded they be handed back. And not for the first time. Both the UK and Falkland governments quickly issued defiant responses, with David Cameron vowing to do everything he could to protect the islanders' desire to remain British. Well, joining us on the line to talk about this from Buenos Aires is a Brit living in Argentina, Monocle correspondent Ed Stocker. Welcome back to Midori House, Ed. Is this a sign that the big anniversary might be over, but this is not going to go away now?
Sorry, can you repeat the question? The line went cut out.
Oh, sorry about that, Ed. Well, last year was the anniversary. It's now not the anniversary in calendar terms. This isn't going to go away, is it?
It's certainly not. I mean, this is part of the Argentinian strategy, basically, to keep protesting about what it sees as the colonial attitude of the UK. And Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner's open letter to the government and David Cameron, taken out through Abbott's and a couple of national newspapers, basically is asking the government to sit down and negotiate as an accord from the 1960s from the UN asks. But obviously, as you were just saying, the UK has a very different point of view and sees the Falklanders as having a right to self-determination.
It's going
to be a referendum in March.
We'll come to that referendum in a second, Ed, but it's a very strange way to do international diplomacy, isn't it? Taking out adverts in newspapers.
It is, and it's not the first time, to be honest. I mean, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner has handed a letter to David Cameron at a G20 conference. She's actually taken out adverts in UK newspapers before. I think it's just, you know, it's just part of her way, I guess, of continuing to manifest or protest in any way possible. And she thinks it's a way of getting through to the government, perhaps, in some way.
And very high-profile actions they are too, which makes me think about the financial situation in Argentina, not a wonderful one at this point. This is a fairly useful distraction from that, isn't it?
It is indeed. I mean, this is perhaps a cynical argument, but I think an argument that has some value is that, you know, she is a populist president, and drumming up such a sort of emotive issue as it remains here in Argentina is something that she can fall back on when times get tough. I mean, growth has slowed a lot. I mean, I think the predictions, depending on which consultancy you look at, I mean, the growth was around 2% in 2012, and it's expected to be three point something in 2013. So it's slowed massively from the around 7% we had in the last few years. But I guess many European countries would love to have that sort of growth on the flip side, I guess.
You certainly would. I mean, she's doing these very high-profile tactics. We're paying attention to it. David Cameron's sort of trying not to pay attention to it. Are people in Argentina paying much attention?
They certainly are. I mean, today is a big day for Argentina in the sense that it is the 180th anniversary of what they see as the island as having been robbed from them by the British. So it's a date that has resonance for Argentinians because this is an issue that people are taught about at school, you know, from when they're growing up. There are signs everywhere. So it does, in a sense, cut to a core for many Argentinians. But having said that, there are some people who feel a sense of fatigue, the fact that this is still going on now, still rumbling on. And as I was just saying before, with the referendum in March, 2013 doesn't look like, you know, being any different in that sense.
Well, on the subject of that referendum, that's the sort of fact that British Prime Minister goes to each time this comes up. We'll have the referendum and we'll wait to see what they think. But as far as Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner reckons, this referendum is illegitimate in the first place because the voters are sort of occupiers as far as she's concerned. So are we not heading for a bit of an impasse here?
Well, exactly. That's it. I mean, what there are two very different interpretations, I guess, of the Falklands or Malvinas and their status. Both sides are essentially parroting the same arguments they've always used, the fact that, you know, as you were saying, the Argentinians believe that the people are on the island are an occupying force. You know, their version of history starts before that they should have inherited the islands from the Spanish, and therefore they should they should be Argentinian to this day. The British came along and occupied them, whereas, you know, the British government saying that these people want to be British, they've chosen to be British. So it's two different versions of history, two different opposing views, and neither side looking likely to budge an inch.
If either of them do budge an inch, we'll be back to talk to you about it again, Ed. But for the moment, thank you very much. That's our correspondent, Ed Stocker, in Buenos Aires. You're listening to Midori House, and we'll be back right after this to find out why Iceland is so picky about what its citizens are called.
Montclair, keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
If you've ever wondered how the shirt on your back came into being, or the roof over your head, the chair you sit on, the laptop you tap on, the office you work in, the train, plane, car, boat, bicycle and lift that transport you, the phone you talk on, or even the bath that you soak in. If you want to know about the things that you live with, then tune into Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dip into the world of design. Premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, we hop from front row to back street, workshop to fairground, taking in the latest in the worlds of architecture, fashion, retail, transport, technology and graphics. If you want to know how design impacts your daily life and who the people are dedicated to making life better, then pull up a pew and tune in.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
This is Midori House. It is 18:39 here in London, the same time in Reykjavik. What's in a name? Well, plenty if you're Icelandic, and especially if you're a 15-year-old girl called Blair. It means gentle breeze in Icelandic, which is, of course, lovely. But sadly, it's not legal. Icelandic babies may only be named from a closed list, and Blair's mum broke those rules. So Blair, who's been called that name all her life, she's decided to sue the Icelandic government. On today's edition of The Brief, Emma Nelson spoke about exactly this and Icelandic names in general with Georgian Helgason from the Icelandic Broadcasting Corporation.
It's an interesting story. The mother decides to give her this name, which does not... Well, the reason that the committee, this personal name register, gives for rejecting the name is that, in essence, it is a masculine form of or word, so it wouldn't fit to name a girl, give a girl this name. So in legal terms, she is only known in the system as girl, or stulka, girl, which is the name that is given to every girl born in the first weeks before a formal name is given and the registration is changed. So she still has that. So legally, she is known as simply as girl, but goes by this name, which the committee has rejected.
What kind of daily problems does this pose for her, to be called girl on all her official documents? That must be very hard for her daily life.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And of course, I would believe that's the name that is on all her sort of personal, on her cards and on her passport, I would think, and all of that. So that's probably just very very difficult and for her, I would think.
How many
so it's
people?
It's going to be an interesting case.
How many people are there in her position?
I'm not sure that there are many people in her position. I think that people tend to then just choose another name or something like that. They don't go overboard to try and force a solution, I think. I have not heard of a case similar to this before. But, of course, people try to have and try to reason, give very thoughtful reasoning for why they want to use a particular name. And the main thing that the committee takes note of is, of course, how the name would fit into the Icelandic system how it would be pronounced. If it's Icelandic letters, for example, names starting with C have usually been rejected for the simple reason that C is not part of the Icelandic alphabet. For one reason, and also if the name sort of fits in with the grammar in Icelandic. So, for example, this year the name Pedro was approved simply because it fits into the Icelandic grammar, even though it's sort of with a foreign name, not usually a name used in Iceland, for example. So it's a sort of a strict interpretation of how the Icelandic language works, and they decide upon that, but this is something that always causes debate in Iceland when the committee presents its decisions for the year, and it's always highly contested in Iceland. Why did you reject this and accept that?
What's the effect on a country when you have a closed list of names? Does it perhaps stifle individualism in terms of self-expression by parents or indeed by people who want to change their names or are a little bit older? Or does it create a sense of national identity of which the Iceland may well be proud?
I think it might at least in the past has presented a sort of preserved a national identity. But I think people are more and more trying to sort of have this system changed and want to use the names that they feel are beautiful or unique in any way or something like that. And you've seen a little bit of a change perhaps in the last few years. I know, for example, the names like I saw mentioned in reports on this story, the name Elvis was permitted a few years back because it simply fits into the Icelandic grammar, even though it might have been rejected some years ago. And then there's always these specific cases where you have to take a decision not on grammar maybe, but on the possibility that the name might in some way scar a child for some years. There were people who wanted to have approved the name Satania. I know that was mentioned also in one report, which was a famous example here in Iceland, and it was rejected because it was considered to be too close to the word Satan, so people thought that would be unacceptable, even though it might have been fit into the system and the grammar.
That was Gudjorn Helgason from the Icelandic Broadcasting Corporation, speaking rather fascinatingly to Monocle's Emma Nelson on today's edition of The Briefing. Staying in Iceland now, and this is a boy named Venus. I don't know if Venus is a legitimate name or not, but the song is by Björk.
Fair.
That was Bjork with Boy Named Venus. Now, you might associate Gap with nice, practical, sort of smart, sort of colourful clothes. You probably don't associate it with high-end luxury. But the go-to jeans and t-shirt brand has taken a leap into the luxury market this week with the acquisition of the very nice women's brand Intimix. Well, joining us on the line to tell us what this branching out is all about is Dana Mattioli. She's retail reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Dana, welcome to Midori House.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to have you on. Now, tell us, how successful at the moment is Intimix?
So Intimix is a private company. They're owned by Private Equity Group, and it's a smaller company. There's only 30 stores in the U.S., a few in Canada, and they do about $130 million in sales a year. So it's smaller, but they're this incubator of high-end brands. So they were discovering like Rag & Bone, and they carry Hervé Leger and a bunch of other brands that you wouldn't associate with Gap, per se.
I certainly wouldn't associate them with Gap. So what exactly is it, then, that Intimix has got that Gap wants?
So Intimix gives Gap this nice entry point into luxury. So Gap has brands like Old Navy and Banana Republic, Gap, Piperlime, that are more, you know, lower to middle-class brands, not very high-priced. And one of the core strategies of their CEO is to go international and go places like China and parts of Europe and emerging markets where they're just really luxury obsessed. And low price point brands aren't really going to do well there. So this is a nice way to get a stronger foothold abroad.
I see. So in the areas where Gap is traditionally strong, in the nations where it's traditionally strong, they aren't places where Gap really needs to be trendy, are they? I mean, Intimix says it's the place for trendsetters. Gap is more a place for people who follow trends and the brands associated with it. So is this something that really is going to be noticed at all by the markets where Gap is traditionally strong?
One thing that I think people are excited about is this could help Gap improve their fashion. So, you know, Gap's image has kind of gone up and down over the years, and it's gone through this kind of dusty point in the last few years where sales were down and, you know, their colors were off and they were missing trends. And, you know, we spoke with their executives yesterday, and they said on their store walks, merchants would go to places like Intermix that were really good at spotting new trends and up-and-coming designers. And having this type of label on board could help them get ahead of trends and have more exclusive collaborations with companies and designers like Diane von Furstenberg, like they did last year, and help them improve their image and get more stylish.
I mean, Gap famously tried to change its logo and then changed it back when there was a huge outcry. So that at least gave them a reputation for listening to what consumers want. Has there been much of a demand from their existing consumers for this sort of transition?
Absolutely. So what we're seeing happen in the middle market for companies like Gap is they're really losing a lot of share to places like Zara and H&M that are really good at fast fashion. And these companies can't ignore that anymore. They have to improve their fashion and realize that they're losing customers to maybe, you know, lesser price point brands like even Forever 21 that are just good at following trends and getting the trends into the stores quickly and might focus less on basics. So I think it's something that their designers and their merchants are looking to improve, and this is a good way of doing that. Even though Intermix doesn't create its own product, they're more good at curating product from other brands, but this is a nice little brand for Gap to have in their arsenal.
I mean, up until this point, Dana, has Gap sort of been guilty of being, you know, neither fast nor particularly fashionable nor particularly high-end, and it's sort of inhabited this middle ground rather sort of weakly. Is that likely to change?
I would say that was definitely the case when their new CEO inherited the company. They've made some adjustments to become faster, and they got rid of their head designer when he came in. So they've made improvements, but this is a step in the right direction for sure. And I think this will just accelerate what we see in those improvements. Like, they had a great spring last year with their colored denim, and then they were one of the first companies to really jump on that trend, and they sold a lot of them. And I think they just need to be more consistent with getting the trends in the store at the time that the customers want them.
Dana, you're saying that this is all with a view to international expansion. How is the US market going? And is Gap still that sort of bastion of sort of middle-of-the-road, comfortable US fashion?
Gap has improved in the US, but that's after years of lagging here, really, to the point where they're closing 20% of their store base in North America. So it's a brand that's known for basics, but they're getting increased competition from places like Japan's Uniqlo, that's also great at basics and has a Japanese styling, and they're losing share to some of the more fashionable companies. So with that in mind, their CEO has cast his eyes abroad, where there's still a demand for American-style clothing, and Gap is synonymous with, you know, that classic American look. So they're really looking elsewhere for growth. And but in the meantime, sales have improved in the U.S., but they're closing a lot of their store base.
Dana, really interesting to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming on Midori House. That was Dana Mattioli. She's a retail reporter for The Wall Street Journal. You are listening to Midori House with me, Dominic Reynolds. Now, if you thought taking a tree down was quite enough of a chore for this end of January, spare a thought for the zookeeper census takers. Yes, in zoos around the world, all the animals, from the giraffes to the cockroaches, are about to get their oddly shaped heads counted. To tell us how and why, I'm joined on the phone by Caroline Howard. She's education presenter at Birmingham's Dudley Zoo. Hello, Caroline. Welcome to Midori House. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent to hear. So, census taking in zoos, why?
Well, there's various different reasons why we do it. One of them is it's actually part of our license agreement. So our local authority needs to know what we have on site. And so we have to tell them every single year just to make sure that they're still aware of everything we have. And it's quite important for us as animal keepers to make sure that we know that all of our records match up with what we're actually working with in the zoo. But it's also quite important because it gets submitted to global databases and part of regional sort of European for us usually stud books, which are helping hopefully to manage the populations of endangered species so that we're safeguarding their futures, so for conservation reasons as well.
I see. So all this census data from all around the world is pooled and put into a sort of animal-based supercomputer, which has a sort of a giant spreadsheet telling us how many of everything there still is.
Something very similar to that, yes. It's online now, and it's called the Zoological Information Management System, ZIMS. And
nice.
We put all of our information about our animals into that. And it means that I can look up a relative of our giraffe that lives in maybe Germany or somewhere like that. And I can get information about not only those animals, but their relatives as well from right around the world, which is a fantastic resource.
Okay, well, that's why. I understand that. What about the how? See, I reckon I could probably count relatively easily the number of gorillas in a particular enclosure, but I might struggle to count the fish. How do you go about counting the awkward ones?
It depends on what they are exactly. So we have, for example, we have 65 penguins at the zoo. And the keepers actually do a weekly count on them just to make sure we know who we have and what. But they all have individual tags on them as well. You can, in theory, look at their chests and tell from their individual markings. But it's a lot easier for the keepers if they have an ID number as well there just to make sure that everyone's looking at the same thing. And so sometimes they'll have individual markings like that. But for things like our cockroaches, for example, we won't know who each individual is. So we record how many are male, how many are female. And you really are just rooting through the enclosure and putting them into a new one, just seeing how many you count on the way past.
So there is someone's, let me just clarify, there is someone whose job it is to go through a cockroach enclosure and pick them up and check whether they're boy or girl cockroaches, and then write it down.
It was actually something that several of my volunteers were doing this afternoon, yeah.
They're volunteers as well. Gosh, what amazing good spirit that is. Has anyone ever sort of said, hey boss, I've been doing the tarantula count and we're one short? Do these censuses ever reveal that there's been a bit of a runaway?
Fortunately, it's a very rare occasion that you'd have anything like that. It's much more likely that you're going to suddenly discover that you have some extra babies that you didn't know about. So, for example, things like our southern crested newts, which are a European species, which are actually threatened as well in the wild now. We've been breeding those, and so I had a few more hatch out today, which will obviously be going on the lists. so that's quite exciting for you. And it's generally good surprises.
That's good to know. Caroline, you're an education presenter. I imagine that means you spend a lot of time explaining what you have at the zoo to visitors and children especially. What are the young people these days sort of particularly interested in? Do they care much about the sort of conservation of these creatures?
Oh, very much. And nowadays, with so much emphasis in schools on things like environmental awareness, it's really refreshing that quite often you get kids who will know about recycling and about how to sort of behave in a very green way. And they can connect that with trying to protect these animals in the environment. So actually, especially the kids in the school groups, they can be really fantastic and tell you a lot about what they're learning at school. It's kind of a lot of it's about getting that message across to everyone and just making sure that everyone remembers that there are really small things that you can do in everyday life that can be helping these creatures, as well as us trying to breed them and make sure that we have them there no matter what's happening to them in the wild.
Now, Caroline, I promise I won't tell any of the other animals in the zoo, but who's your favourite?
It's a difficult choice. Mm. I do love my cockroaches. I have got a big soft spot for the spiders as well, though.
Deary me. I would say that is an atypical response, cockroaches and spiders. But you love what you love, I suppose. Caroline Howard, education presenter at Birmingham's Dudley Zoo, thank you very much for coming on Midori House. And sadly, that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Hannah Jenkins, and to Marcus Hippie too. Our researchers, Emily Aylett and Pilar Lopez, and our studio manager, Ben Jay. Up next, after the news, this week's episode of The Urbanist. Today, Andrew Tuck goes through the best bits of the programme from last year, 2012. Tom Edwards will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.